I will be reading 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 through 5. 1 Peter 5, 1 through 5. I'll be reading from the New King James Version. The elders who are among you I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble.
Over the last several Sunday mornings, we've been going through the book of 1 Peter, and we have come to 1 Peter chapter 5. I hope if you have your Bibles, you've turned there. We're going to spend two more lessons looking through this chapter. We will take a break next week, as remember our special Sunday. David Morris from the Highland Church of Christ will be here with us speaking, thinking about how to study the Bible. We'll have a combined adult class, and then we'll pick right up where we left off that next Sunday. If you know anything about the Swiss railway system, you may know that their trains have a reputation for being on time. There is an incredible precision that comes with making sure when you buy a ticket, you're going to board a train that leaves at a specific time and arrives where it's going to be at a specific time. And so, a few years ago, it made the news when there was a train that left the station without a conductor on board. A cab driver who had been working for 20 years driving a cab said he'd never seen anything like it. When a lady ran out and hailed the cab and got inside, and she still had her ticket taker machine there that she would use as she was on the train, and so she commanded him to go straight to the next stop, and so they drove. She paid a $20 cab fare to go to the next station and to catch up with the train when it stopped so she could get on there and do her job. There was a train that was running without anyone on it, taking tickets, anyone on it, monitoring what was happening. And it reminded me of a story that I heard Marlon Conley tell years ago about a couple that he was friends with that both worked in downtown Nashville. And they would drive the same car together, and they had a spot in a parking garage, and so they would rotate. They found a garage that was a pretty middle point distance. It was pretty equal to walk to his work or her work, and so they kind of found that middle point, and they would just take turns. One week he would drive the car into the parking garage and park it, and the next week she would do that. And so he described one Monday morning as they went to the usual spot where one would stop and let the other out. And so as they got to that one spot in the middle of downtown Nashville, they both got out of the car and started walking to work. And then they realized that as they turned around and saw each other, here was their car right in the middle of the street, just there with nobody behind the wheel. His point in telling that story was that somebody has to drive. And as we think about the early church and the kind of growth that it experienced, even with persecution, the way it was spreading all around, God didn't leave His people without leadership. It wasn't a runaway train without a conductor. It wasn't a car with no one behind the wheel. God had a specific plan for leaders in the early church. And so it makes sense that as Peter is writing to Christians, he's going to have some special instructions, both for the leaders of those Christians there, and then also for those who were under their leadership, who were under their guidance. And so we're going to spend some time this morning looking at what God's Word has to tell us, specifically in 1 Peter chapter 5, about elders, and also about those who were part of that flock, those who were members that are under the leadership of those elders. And I don't know about you, but when I've been places where we've studied the role of elder and the qualities of an elder, many times that occurs right before there's going to be a selection or addition of new elders. And it's a good thing to study those qualities and qualifications during that time. But one of the beauties of looking through the text and reading through Scripture is that you cover every topic. And I think it's great that we have a chance this morning in a time that we're just studying through that we can spend some time thinking about the qualities of leaders in the Lord's church and the qualities that those who are following their leadership need to have. I hope this morning there are some young men here who were thinking right now, what can I do right now? What steps can I take right now to prepare myself so that in the future, if the opportunity arises, in the future, if God provides me with that opportunity, that I can serve as an elder? I hope there are young men thinking about that. I hope all of us can look at the kind of qualities that God wants in an elder and realize that those are qualities we need to instill in all of our lives, no matter what our role is. And so we begin with the first verse of 1 Peter chapter 5, where we see Peter is not only speaking to the elders, but he's speaking in a special sense as a fellow elder. And so when he writes, "So I exhort the elders among you as a fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed, shepherd the flock that is among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you. Not for shameful gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over to those allotted to your charge, proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. Likewise, you who are younger, be subject to the elders. Clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility toward one another. For God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble." We have these very specific instructions that deal with two groups, and we'll think of them this morning as specifically pointing to the elders and to the members, to those who are part of the flock that these elders are shepherding. And there are specific ways that Peter describes both of these roles. As he begins describing the role of elder, we see very clearly that elders are, and as Peter makes it clear, being one of the elders, elders are human beings. Elders are human. The reason I point that out, although that may seem incredibly obvious, is that sometimes when we look at the list of qualities that Paul writes to Timothy and Titus about, we begin to think of it as if it's this unreachable standard, that there's no way anybody could meet all of these qualifications. And sometimes we walk away from those texts with the idea that this is some sort of perfect person that we're looking for. We think of someone who is described as blameless, as a blameless person who's never made a mistake. And yet it's very clear just from this description that Peter, when we look at his background, being both an elder, we also know his mistakes probably more so than any other individual in the Bible. We've discussed them even some in the last few weeks. Who was it that rebuked Jesus when he told his apostles what was going to happen, that he was going to have to go and to die? Who was it that Jesus said to, "Get behind me, Satan"? Who was it that was walking on the water and lost sight of Jesus when he was worried about the wind and the waves that were around him? Who was it on the Mount of Transfiguration, as Moses and Elijah were there, that piped up with the idea, "We should make three tabernacles, one for each of you," missing the point that Jesus was the one he was supposed to worship? Who was it that said, "Even if everybody else falls away, I won't fall away from you"? Who was it that grabbed his sword, that managed to get an ear off of one of the soldiers that was there to arrest Jesus? Who was it that vehemently denied being associated with Jesus? Or even the one later on who would refuse when certain people came around to eat with Gentile Christians, even though God through him spread the gospel to the Gentiles. No, if we're looking for an individual to serve as an elder who has never made a mistake, we wouldn't be looking for Peter. And yet Peter here is saying that he is a fellow elder. And so it's important to remember that those who serve as elders are human beings. And that also means that we can encourage them, we can lift them up, and it can really make a difference. You know, if you've ever been in a position of leadership, if you've been serving at work in a position of leadership, or leadership in an organization, getting a group together, what do leaders often hear the most? They often hear complaints, or when something goes wrong, or when there's an issue that needs to be addressed. Now, obviously, you go to leaders with those issues, but I wonder how many times those who are leading in any capacity, in any organization, just receive encouragement. Specifically, when we think about the elders that lead us here, I wonder if we're providing that kind of encouragement. I need to ask myself, when is the last time I just encouraged one of those who is shepherding this congregation? It's a powerful challenge to remember. To remember that. And also, there is another image that he uses to describe elders, and it's one that's used several times in the New Testament. And that's the image of a shepherd. that elders are shepherds. Now, as we've gone through and studied different texts, even talking about what it meant to truly follow Jesus, who Peter would describe as the chief shepherd, we've talked a little bit about this imagery. But it's important that we keep reminding ourselves of what a shepherd was, because that's not something we see just driving up I-65. But we don't see a lot of shepherds with their flocks. And yet, when we think about where Peter was writing and who he was writing to, they would have known what a shepherd was. They would have known that a shepherd knew his sheep. They would have known that a shepherd was always going to protect his sheep, which in many cases would have been a big investment on the part of his family. They would have known that sheep were not very smart, that they didn't have any kind of defenses for predators, that they could fall over on their back and become cast, and their legs would be hanging in the air, and there's nothing they could do to roll over on some occasions, that they needed a shepherd to provide them with places to graze and water to drink. They would have understood that. And so we need to understand it as well, because it paints a powerful picture. Now, Peter's very clear that all of us are following the chief shepherd. But as we look at God's plan in the New Testament, we have congregations that are led by shepherds. Shepherding in a spiritual sense, being out among the flock and knowing the sheep. And I've been so encouraged in all the ways that I've seen our elders here shepherding, in some ways that are behind the scenes. We might not realize all the shepherding that's taking place, but it's happening. Oftentimes when we think of elders, we think of decision making, and that's important. That's an important part of serving as a leader in a congregation, is making those decisions. But there are so many other demands on their time and on their schedule that take place outside the walls of a church building or the walls of a conference room. There are times in the homes of individuals who are struggling. Time spent in funeral homes, in hospital rooms, and praying with families who need help, and eating lunch with people to see what different ideas for ministry that can be nurtured and that can be encouraged, and seeing what different ways we can reach out in our mission work. There are so many ways that elders and their families sacrifice their time and effort in order to provide that kind of shepherding. And so it's important to realize that. Philip Keller has written many different books from the viewpoint of a shepherd. His most famous was A Shepherd Looks at the 23rd Psalm. And he made a statement in that book that I've never forgotten. He said that the lot of life for any particular sheep depends on the one who owns it. In other words, the lot in life for any sheep depends on who the owner is. It depends on who the shepherd is. And there are some shepherds that he describes that treated their sheep very well, and there are some that he describes that had neglected their sheep. And he points to that particular relationship. And so when we think about serving the chief shepherd, and we realize that I could choose to serve a lot of different people and go in a lot of different directions in this world, but when I'm serving the chief shepherd, when I'm allowing Him to guide me, and He's doing that through the elders, the shepherds that are appointed spiritually in order to lead His people, then I know I've made the right decision. Sometimes there are formative moments that happen when we're younger, things that we never forget. And I've been blessed in my life to know several men who've served as elders and set tremendous examples. And one of those that I can remember growing up was, I guess I was in elementary school, and it was a Sunday night, and there was an individual in our congregation that came forward. And she was a young lady who was confessing to something that was public in nature that many others knew about. And she had written out a statement that was read, asking for forgiveness. And I can still remember even part of that statement where she indicated, I don't know if anyone would be able to forgive me. And I can remember that statement being read, and then, as was the custom, one of the elders came up in order to lead a prayer. And he looked out over the congregation and he said, you know, we should be so thankful that this young lady has come forward, that she's made this statement. I'm so thankful that she has the courage to do this. I know that we all love her. I know that we all want to wrap our arms around her and show her how much we love her and forgive her. And I'm so glad that she handled it this way, Now, I don't have any doubt that that's the way the congregation would have reacted. I don't have any doubt that people would have been forgiving and been comforting. But it was just an example of one of the shepherds that was setting the tone, that was shepherding, that knew and loved the sheep. And we're blessed to have those kinds of shepherds here at Graymere. And so the question we have to ask as we think about this is, how are we responding? Peter describes elders as human, as shepherds, and he also uses the image of an overseer. Now, when we look at a term like overseer, we might automatically think someone at work who's a supervisor. But the picture of elders as overseers would have been very familiar to early Christians. In fact, as we read through the Gospels, we find out that there were Jewish elders in different locations even before we see the church established. In Mark 11, in verse 27, some of the members of the Sanhedrin were Jewish elders. There were also elders that were in local Jewish communities. In Luke chapter 7, in verse 3, we see a reference to those elders that were decision makers. We see often pictured them sitting at the gates. They would be the ones who sort of made the decisions for that community. And so this idea of overseers would have been very familiar. There were older men who were experienced, and so they provided some judgments and disputes. And it's also a reminder, too, that as Peter is describing elders and those who are exercising oversight, that it's not just an honorary title or a position, that it requires that active work. And he says they don't do it under compulsion, that it's not something that's forced on someone, but they do it out of the desire to serve God. And they also don't do it for any kind of sordid gain. In John chapter 10, when Jesus describes himself as the good shepherd, one of those I am statements in John, he also compares himself to a hired hand, to someone who comes in and is just really in it for the money and doesn't really know the sheep the way a shepherd knows the sheep. And by doing that, he's illustrating he is the true shepherd. Well, it makes sense when we think about the kinds of overseers in the Lord's church that it's not something that's done for sordid gain, as Peter describes in verse 2. When Paul wrote to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 5, he talked about some elders worthy of double honor, indicating not only respect, but also some financial gifts that would have been given. And so he's saying, that's not why you're in this. You're in this because you want to serve God with eagerness. And you don't lord it over to those that are allotted to you. That's the kind of worldly leadership they would have been familiar with. You don't lord it over someone. You're serving God. And then in verse 4, that promise, when the chief shepherd appears, you'll receive the unfading crown of glory. The last image that he uses of spiritual leaders, of elders in the church, is the image of an example. He says, you're proving to be examples to those that you're leading. There's a quote that Dwight Eisenhower made famous years ago when he described leaders and the way leaders relate to followers. And he said, the supreme quality for a leader is unquestionably integrity. Without it, no real success is possible, no matter whether it is on a section gang, a football field, in an army, or in an office. If a man's associates find him guilty of phoniness, if they find that he lacks forthright integrity, he will fail. Well, it shouldn't surprise us because it's here in the text that those who lead serve as examples. How many times have we seen a media frenzy over someone who claimed to be a religious leader and then a scandal is discovered? All of us understand what it's like to see someone who claims one thing but lives another way. And so Peter's making sure they understand those who are elders are going to serve as examples. They're going to serve as visual clues as to how to live the Christian life. And so we see those descriptions of elders. And then he has some very important things to say to those who would be members, to those who would be part of that spiritual flock. And if there's one thing that I could just remind us of as well as we think about the relationship, is that when we think of members of a congregation, members are also human beings. Again, it might sound obvious, but if we understand that as part of a spiritual family, we're all human, which means we'll all fail at some point, that we'll all let each other down, then we can have a patience that allows us to grow together, to forgive one another. If you hang around with me long enough, I'm going to do something that disappoints you. It won't be intentional, but I'll let you down. Something is going to happen where I'll drop the ball and I won't do something I'm supposed to do. And if we understand as brothers and sisters in Christ that we're all human, and that those who are serving us as deacons, and those who are leading us as elders, and those who are serving in various ministries, that we're all human, that will help us as we continue to grow together. And not only that, but members are also a part of a flock. Now, the reason I think that's an important distinction is we live in an individualized society. We like to insulate ourselves from what happens around us, but that's not the picture we see in the New Testament. From very early on, when we see the church established in the book of Acts, we see members meeting together and worshiping. And it wasn't something that you did in isolation. You didn't live the Christian life in isolation. You were constantly meeting and being encouraged by your fellow believers. And there were congregations that were planted. And sometimes they met in homes, and sometimes they met other places, but there were groups that were united together in service. Even when Jesus sent his apostles out on what is sometimes called the limited commission, he didn't send them alone. He sent them in pairs. There's something about that encouragement that we need. And as we think about serving in a flock, we realize we're part of a group. We're part of a spiritual family. The Christian life is not one I walk by myself. And that's so vital for us to remember. We see not only the responsibility that those have who are shepherding the flock, but we also understand the responsibility we have as members of that flock, the responsibility we have to one another. Jesus called himself the Good Shepherd. And if I'm going to follow the Good Shepherd, then I'm going to need to submit to the spiritual shepherds of a congregation where I serve. I'm going to need to be a part of that flock. And in submitting to that leadership, I'm truly submitting to the leadership of the Good Shepherd. I like the old story about a rural congregation that's got a small building, and as you walk out over the fields and the valleys into this building where there's not much parking and there's no electricity, one of the responsibilities of each member was to bring a lantern that you would hang on little hooks that extended on the walls. And so when everybody got there, there were enough lanterns that the light was bright enough and they would have a worship service together at night. When someone's light wasn't there, they knew that person was missing. And every member felt the responsibility to be there. If not, your light wouldn't be provided. As part of a flock, we're in this together. Time and time again, we see Christians in the New Testament that were meeting together. And even when the author of Hebrews would say that you don't need to get out of habit of that, you don't need to neglect meeting together, it's because it's important for us to have that kind of fellowship. So we have the fact that members are a flock, and also that we're followers. That we have the God-given responsibility to submit to leadership. And that's not easy, because a lot of times we like to make our own decisions. We like to be in charge of what we do and where we go, but the example is set here that we submit to those. In fact, the way Peter would describe it in verse 5, he would say, "You younger men likewise, be subject to your elders." In other words, there's a submission that's going to take place there. You may have heard about a young lady who applied to college, and one of the questions on that college entrance exam was, "Are you a leader?" And she was very eager to get into college, but she also was an honest person, so she just put no. And they sent her back an acceptance letter. And in that letter, it read, "You should know that we have incoming this year 1,492 leaders that are freshmen, and we think it's imperative they have at least one follower. And so we'd like to accept you." So she got it. Sometimes it takes courage to admit, I'm going to be a follower. I'm going to submit. And yet that's the pattern that we're called to do. And in fact, any time that God has raised up a leader, that leader has needed willing followers. Time and time again, when God led his people into battle, there would be specific instructions that the leader would have to relay. And when they followed those instructions, they could have success in battle. Or even Nehemiah, that we read about coming back and rebuilding the temple. Nehemiah's plan to rebuild the temple was to put everyone to work. And that meant he had people working working on those walls. There were people who weren't experienced masons. There were people from all different kinds of walks of life that might not have known anything about building a wall, but that was part of his leadership. He was requiring them to do that, and they followed. They submitted. Because of that, the walls were rebuilt. And so as we think about our role as Christians, we're called to follow. And not only that, but we're called to humility. We're called to be humble. He says in verse 5, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. That term there for clothing or putting on humility indicates tying something around, almost like putting on an apron or something where you're tying that around. And I just can't read this verse without thinking of John 13. Of Jesus taking that towel and taking the role of a servant. Talk about a role of humility, of washing others' feet. He set that tremendous example. And so Peter, who was there when that took place, even the one who resisted at first, saying he didn't want his feet to be washed until Jesus explained that unless he let him do that, that he would have no part in him. Peter is here saying, clothe yourselves with humility. Put on humility. It's important for us to do that, to understand that as we submit to leadership, we serve one another in humility. In a world that focuses so much on puffing ourselves up and trying to prove ourselves and trying to look like we're the ones who have it all together. And even sometimes when we come together to worship, we can feel this pressure to sort of put on a front like we've got everything together and try to sort of prove ourselves. And yet Peter says, serve one another with humility. And he reminds them that God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. He'd go on in verse 6 to say, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time. I can exalt myself on earth, but that's not going to last long. That's not going to have any lasting effect. But if I humble myself and allow God to exalt me, that would have eternal implications. And that could allow me to have an eternal inheritance that there's no way I deserve, but through obedience to God, I have access to through His grace. We see some very important keys here in 1 Peter chapter 5. As he's writing to a church that's struggling with suffering, he's also promoting the idea of leadership. Those who were serving as elders, doing it the way God had designed, and those who were following their lead, doing it the way God has designed. It's comforting to me to realize that at no point in history did God want His church to be without leadership, to be without someone behind the wheel, to be a runaway train without a conductor on board. God has provided leadership. God has provided a plan. And it's comforting to me to know that as we follow that plan, we're following the chief shepherd. And it may be tonight or this morning, that is the second week in a row I've done that. I don't know. I think now it's a mental thing. It could be that tonight, but especially this morning. As we think about what it means to truly submit to God's leadership, it may be that your life feels like some sort of runaway train, that you don't have anybody in the driver's seat, that you don't have any sense of control. And what a relief to have that sense of control when you come and put on Christ in baptism, and through obedience to His will, you can serve Him. Or it may be that there's something else in your life, an issue that needs to be addressed. If there's any way we can help you, please come as we stand, as we sing together.